Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. The G8 has changed nothing. While the West has asserted its determination to bring down the Syrian dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, Russia stands defiantly by its ally. As sectarian bloodshed meets Cold War antagonism, we discuss what can the world possibly do to help poor Syria. I'm joined in the studio by Benedict Brogan, deputy editor of the Daily Telegraph, the Telegraph's defence editor, Con Coughlan, and by Janet Daly, a Sunday Telegraph columnist. The conflict in Syria is thought to have claimed 93,000 lives in 2 years, and now this tragic civil war is threatening to become a global confrontation. At this week's G8 summit, some of the gathered leaders appear to try to engineer a coup within the Syrian government, and Britain, France and America have, to varying degrees, offered moral and material assistance to the rebels. That could put the West into direct confrontation with Iran and, crucially, Russia. Vladimir Putin ended the G8 on an awkward note when he warned that arming the rebels might be putting weapons into the hands of the very kind of people who beheaded drummer Lee Rigby in Woolwich. And Putin is dashing hopes of a peace conference in Geneva too. Meanwhile, the fighting continues and the bodies mount on both sides with reports of mass murder, rape and even cannibalism. What we're going to discuss today is where the West stands now in the Syrian conflict, how we got here and where we're going. And I'd like to start by taking us right up to date and asking Con Coughlan, has the G8 changed anything?
No, I don't think so. I think the final appeal to Assad's supporters to overthrow the regime shows that the West is basically clutching at straws. This is never going to happen. I don't think anybody who knows the way the Assad regime works believes that the military, most of whom are Alawites and are members of the Assad clan, are suddenly going to turn tables on the president and get rid of him. And I think the very fact that people like the Prime Minister and President Obama are talking in these terms shows that very little was actually accomplished at the G8 summit.
Ben, would you agree the communique was a fudge?
Certainly, in the way that communiques from the G8 gathering, where there are too many different views, are by their very nature a fudge. The fact is that it's a statement of platitudes. David Cameron tried to make the best of it, and certainly the summit's attempt to try to destabilize Syria verbally was quite laughable. We are still where we were before the G8 summit, which is that the West wrings its hands and the serious players in the region line up against each other. And meanwhile, Syria becomes increasingly the cockpit for a rather nasty sectarian conflict that is spreading widely into the region.
Can you explain for us, just to sort of stack up both sides and what their motivations are, why is Vladimir Putin taking this position?
What I'm struck by when I speak to British diplomats is their puzzlement at the precise reasons why Putin is taking such a hard line on this, because the Westerners will say, well, we've offered Russia all the sort of reassurances that you think they would want for life in Syria after the Assad regime, namely preserving Russian interests in the region, the intelligence and naval bases in the west coast of Syria. If those are protected, those are guaranteed for Russia, then you could argue that they have no particular interest in keeping Assad. One dictator is as good as the next one. So there is a degree of mystery surrounding it, but the fact is that Russia has always seen that part of the world as its sphere of influence. And of course, it worries more broadly at anything that looks like any kind of Western alliance that starts deciding which dictators should stand and which should fall, mm-hmm. because of course, one day those kind of questions might be asked much more closely to home.
And Con, what about Iran? I mean, one thing that surprises me is that we start to see this unspoken alliance developing between Russia and Iran. Will Iran's relationship with Assad change post the election? And what is its interests in Syria?
Well, actually, Iran's interests in Syria are far more crucial than Russia's. Syria is a vital strategic ally for Tehran. It is the conduit for Iran's relationship with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. All the arms for Hezbollah go through Damascus. Not surprisingly, Hezbollah fighters are now fighting to save the Assad regime. And I don't see Iran changing its position post the election vis-a-vis Syria. I think the Iranian intervention in Syria has helped to turn the tide of the fighting Assad's way. And I think Iran is now looking to claim victory in Syria with all the implications that will have for its future dealings with the West.
Okay. So then to move to the Western side of the conflict, Janet, why on earth is America getting involved?
Why hasn't it got involved in the last 2 years? That's the question.
Okay, why?
The vacuum that has been left by Obama's retreat from the world stage is what has made this entire situation so hopeless and so inflamed. The mystery about Putin, I mean, Putin is into Cold War II, you know. This is the second version of the Cold War, and it's all about geopolitical influence rather than ideology. Maybe the Cold War was always about geopolitical influence and not ideology. But the point is that he sees sphere of influence and the march of Russian sort of hegemony as his main raison d'etre. America has decided, made exactly the opposite decision, and decided to retreat from the global stage. This threat that Putin has made about the fact that if you arm these rebels, you'll be arming al-Qaeda, you'll be arming the very terrorists who are threatening your security, it has force now because, in fact, we've handed over the region to al-Qaeda. By America pulling away in the way that it has, it's effectively said to a whole generation of young, agitating, dissident people in this region, we're not going to help you. You're on your own. You may as well turn to your Islamist brothers. They're the only people who are interested in you. Forget about us. And as a consequence, the vacuum has been filled by the people you would expect it to be filled by.
But America supported the opposition in Libya. America supported the surge
From behind, if you remember. Obama led from behind. It was France and Britain who were really the people who were engaged with the Libyan struggle for you know, complicated post-colonial reasons and so on. But the point was that America doesn't want to know. It doesn't even want to know about its sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. I mean, Obama made that quite clear in the first year of his presidency. He visited Eastern Europe and said, we're repositioning our missiles. We're pulling out of here. You're on your own. We now want to spend the money on welfare programs at home, just like you do. You're going to have to defend yourselves. Obama has had a systematic policy of pulling out he gave a speech just a few weeks ago saying the war on terror is effectively over. Well, a war isn't over until the other side decides that it's over.
Well, of course,
you can't unilaterally decide that the war is over.
His liberal critics, and we can't ignore the Snowden thing that's going on right now, his liberal critics would say that actually he's the opposite, that he's almost an imperialist. I mean, you've got the drone strikes in Pakistan. Yeah. You've got the fact that he didn't withdraw immediately from Afghanistan or from Iraq.
Yeah, American foreign policy, though, is very complex. So the president doesn't have that much power. You know, the Pentagon and the what we would call the Defense Department have an enormous amount of power, and the State Department, and to some extent foreign policy and military policy was carrying on as in the template that had been set up by the previous administration. Obama's rhetoric, though, which is really what presidents are judged by and administrations are judged by, has been the opposite. And he, in that last speech that he gave, he said, we're going to cut back on the unmanned drone attacks. We're going to see to it that civilians are not killed by drones. We're going to dismantle the whole war on terror apparatus. He has given as open and blatant a signal as he possibly could to that region of the world to say, it's up to you now.
Okay, Ben, you've just come back from Afghanistan. Do you agree with that description of Obama's foreign policy?
It certainly feels like that. It feels as if America has sort of deserted the stage and hasn't really engaged. Traditionally, in presidencies, you often find that it is the second term where a president who no longer has to worry about re-election finds that they can spare the time to interest themselves in foreign matters and engage with big, pressing questions of international policy. One gets the impression with Obama that that is not the case, that he's not engaging. And, of course, by leaving things till the last minute, he's incredibly narrowed his room for maneuver, his options. And I think that what the Americans are contemplating in Syria is the thought that, do we really want to involve ourselves in another foreign adventure just at a time when we have pulled off the political feat of walking away from Afghanistan, regardless of what the political situation is there?
Something you wrote recently which disturbed me greatly was the idea that Britain has to go along with this if America's involved. So does that mean this isn't really about David Cameron's moral leadership pushing the West into engagement in Syria? This is really just about trying to judge what America wants to do and then follow on behind?
I think there is a question that Britain has to confront and has had to confront for decades, which is the extent of our autonomy, our ability to be an independent actor in on the world stage, particularly militarily. The fact is that experience teaches us that our room for maneuver to do things by ourselves is actually sorely limited, not least by the cost of austerity and the fact that we have pared down our defence capability to the bone. And also there is a more... Tony Blair understood very clearly that for Britain, looking forward, not just next year, but over the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, that the place one always wants to be in terms of Britain's national interests to prepare and anticipate whatever the big international challenges might be is close to America. But and that hope requires an engagement with America, that it requires a willingness to show oneself able and willing to be alongside America wherever it goes.
But Ben, on Libya specifically, and even now to some extent on Syria, it's European countries, Britain and France, who are leading, and America is following.
But they led, and they could only have gone if America had followed.
Oh, yes.
And I think that was part of an understanding that that relationship is always a symbiotic relationship that requires working in tandem. And I think I was just posing the question that whether it's in Syria, certainly in Afghanistan, in Iraq, for a British prime minister, the one thing they always have to ask themselves, do I need to engage with America now, for example, here in Syria, in order to be sure that if the time comes in future, I have a relationship with America that allows me to be taken seriously.
But there is some evidence that after William Hague's visit to Washington, where he apparently, you know, urged the president to become more committed and engaged with this, that was when the change took place. And Obama started talking about the use of gas, you know, the use of chemical weapons, and therefore a red line being crossed, and therefore we will consider. And that seemed to follow directly from whatever it was William Hague said to him in private.
Which also happened in the 1990s when it was Tony Blair pushing Clinton into engagement in the Balkans.
Absolutely.
We seem to be the people who sort of morally pressure America into
action. Tony Blair would probably argue that the ability, the willingness of Washington to listen to those arguments is partly conditional on our willingness and ability to be present at the times when America asks us to be involved.
Oh, yes.
But how willing are we, Con, because right now we're actually cutting troop numbers?
Well, I think the spirit is willing, and I think actually if you talk to the military, they are willing to get involved for the right mission. And with Syria, I think the feeling is very strongly that, you know, we need to keep well away from Syria because, you know, after the experience of Libya, and Libya is now a basket case thanks to our military intervention 2 years ago, what would replace Assad if we were to find a way to support the nice guys in Syria, if such a thing exists? You know, what would be the outcome? But having said that, you know, the military remain very committed to Afghanistan, and coming back to what Ben was saying about the weakness of the Obama presidency. Obama at the G8 summit, at the end of the G8 summit, made much of the fact that talks are opening with the Taliban. What he didn't say is that in order for this to happen, the Obama administration has dropped a vital precondition for the opening of those talks, namely that the Taliban ditches its relationship with al-Qaeda. And the reason Obama's been forced to do this is because he's embarked on this cut-and-run policy from Afghanistan. And so he's now desperately scrambling around trying to get a political deal before the troops
before
come
the
home.
Yeah.
And everybody who's followed this, and Ben's just been there, we've all said time and again there's no military solution to the Afghan conflict, but the military element is required to put pressure on the Taliban to come to the table. And the Taliban have been disinclined to do that from the moment Obama said at West Point 3.5 years ago that we were leaving. Mm. So now he's running around trying to stitch together a deal with the Taliban. And so long as Mullah Omar is still playing footsie with al-Qaeda, that deal is not worth anything to the West.
But that implies that we should have made an open-ended commitment to do whatever was necessary to beat the opposition in Afghanistan. And that's a commitment which surely no politician...
Well, Tim, all I would say to that is, you know, on D-Day in 1944, we didn't say we would get the troops home by March 1945. Yeah. I mean, there are ways of doing this. It wasn't an open-ended commitment, but the military element was vital to get the Taliban to the negotiating table on our terms, and that hasn't happened.
And the criticism must be that... pick up on Con's point, that we put in a big military effort, but we never matched it in parallel with a strong political effort that used what we achieved militarily to get the Taliban in the right place.
And this notion that what we want is a ceasefire, of course we want a ceasefire, but you have to enforce a ceasefire, and you can't enforce a ceasefire without at least the possibility of using force. And if you withdraw all your troops and then say piously what we want is a ceasefire, you're talking into the wind.
We should mention finally that the difficulty for Britain is that just at a time when William Hague, as Janet points out, has been successful in getting Britain's voice heard in Washington in terms of shaping foreign policy, we are going through our period of austerity where we are cutting back on military capability. The Americans are noticing and are making increasing noises about how worried they are that Britain won't be able to be an actor in whatever initiatives might come.
And also it will have to go through Parliament.
Exactly. There is, and they won't get a vote. I was talking to MPs earlier who were saying that the one way of dealing with that would be to call the vote in the middle of the August recess and see whether MPs are prepared to interrupt their holidays to vote against military action in Syria. But at the moment, David Cameron would find it very difficult to get House of Commons support for action.
One final question, and it's not an easy yes or no. What should Britain do in Syria? How far should we be prepared to go to help to remove Assad?
Going to give an answer which I should never give this sort of thing, which is I don't know. I think it's really messy and I find it very difficult. I think there is a point at which you can go, which is about providing the opposition with logistical help and military support. But equally, I don't envy David Cameron, who's contemplating giving weapons to the people who, as Vladimir Putin said, are completely umbilically linked ideologically and in terms of outlook to the people who killed drummer Rigby.
Janet.
The question of how far we should go, I think the first question has to be, how ambivalent have we been about Assad? The caricature of the West that is sold to young generations of people in this region is that the West will support any tin pot dictator for its own self-serving reasons. And the fact that we've been so ambivalent about removing Assad at all and only finally getting around to the point of saying he's a genocidal tyrant, he has to go, it's a bit late in the day. It's not very credible now.
And Con.
I think all that's left to do now is try and get Geneva up and running, get the parties to the negotiating table. It's a very remote possibility, but I think realistically that's all we've got left now.
Con Coughlan, Janet Daly and Benedict Brogan, thank you very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.